Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Tom Brokaw, take note. On this Veterans Day, President Obama says today's young Americans are a new greatest generation.
But as we honor the many generations who have served, all of us, every single American, must acknowledge that this generation has more than proved itself the equal of those who've come before.
President Obama speaking yesterday at Fort Hood. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Hello, everyone. Later on this Veterans Day, we will play clips from and meet the director of the Iraq War movie, The Hurt Locker. That'll be in about an hour and a half from now. Also, why the Bear Stearns 2 got off without a scratch in federal court, but their troubles are far from over, and a lot more today. But on this Veterans Day, in a couple of minutes, we'll talk to three vets now going to Columbia University. First, though, an excerpt from President Obama's speech at Fort Hood yesterday, a longer excerpt, where, of course, he went to Fort Hood to honor those killed in the massacre last week. And the news has been running very short sound bites of this speech. We can play a little more, and we thought you'd like to hear it. Here is about 2 minutes of the president talking not just about the fratricide, but his Veterans Day thoughts.
We're a nation that is dedicated to the proposition that all men and women are created equal. We live that truth within our military and see it in the varied backgrounds of those we lay to rest today. We defend that truth at home and abroad. And we know that Americans will always be found on the side of liberty and equality. That's who we are as a people. Tomorrow's Veterans Day. It's a chance to pause and to pay tribute. For students to learn the struggles that preceded them, for families to honor the service of parents and grandparents, for citizens to reflect upon the sacrifices that have been made in pursuit of a more perfect union. For history is filled with heroes. You may remember the stories of a grandfather who marched across Europe, an uncle who fought in Vietnam, a sister who served in the Gulf. But as we honor the many generations who have served, all of us, every single American, must acknowledge that this generation has more than proved itself the equal of those who've come before. We need not look to the past for greatness, because it is before our very eyes. This generation of soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Coast Guardsmen have volunteered in the time of certain danger. They are part of the finest fighting force that the world has ever known. They have served tour after tour of duty in distant, different, and difficult places. They have stood watch in blinding deserts and on snowy mountains. They have extended the opportunity of self-government to peoples that have suffered tyranny and war. They are men and women, white, black, and brown, of all faiths and all stations. All Americans serving together to protect our people while giving others half a world away the chance to lead a better life.
President Obama at Fort Hood, and we will play another excerpt later in the show where he talks briefly about every Fort Hood shooting victim by name. But most of the media talk that's not about Fort Hood this Veterans Day seems to be about homeless vets. That's because Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki launched a new push last week to help homeless vets. The shameful stat is that veterans are more than twice as likely to become homeless than other Americans are. And here is Shinseki talking about it.
If we want to end veteran homelessness, we must attack the entire downward spiral that ends in homelessness. We must offer education, jobs, treat depression, fight substance abuse, prevent suicides, provide safe housing.
So we will now meet three vets on a completely upward track. They are all attending Columbia University. Daniel Flatley is a freshman at Columbia after serving in the Marines the last 5 years, including in Anbar Province in Iraq. He's from Wheeling, West Virginia. He plans to major in English and comparative literature. Rory Minnis enlisted in the Marines in 2000 after graduating from Hunter College High School here in Manhattan. He did two tours in Iraq, ending in 2007. He is at Columbia majoring in Middle East Studies. And John McClelland, his father was in the Air Force, so John grew up in Arizona, Illinois, Ohio, Italy, the Philippines, and Virginia, where he graduated high school and joined the Army on April Fool's Day, 2003, he points out. He has been deployed to Afghanistan four times and has taken part in 200 combat missions. He also did a tour in Iraq. He wants to go to law school and return to the Army as a judge advocate general, specializing in civil rights and criminal investigations. So, John, Rory, Dan, welcome to WNYC, and thanks to all of you for your service to our country.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks
for having us, Brian.
Rory, I know Hunter High School here in Manhattan well. It's for really smart, geeky kids who test well in math and English for the most part. Were you like the only one from your graduating class to join the military?
I was certainly the only one from my graduating class to join the military. Interestingly enough, there was one student from the previous year's class who also joined the Marine Corps. And so I don't know if I was following his trend or not. I don't want to get put in that line. But it was definitely a culture shock. When everybody was getting ready to go off to Harvard and Yale, I was shipping off to Paris Island 2 weeks after graduation.
That's right. Or go right to Columbia. Why did you enlist in 2000?
I felt that I was not yet mature enough to handle the college experience. I felt that I was missing something, that I needed to develop more as a human being, as a person, to get out and see the world before I put more knowledge in my head. I needed a context for that knowledge.
Well, there's a question. Which takes more knowledge? Going to Columbia or going to fight a war halfway around the world?
I think that it's not that it's which takes more knowledge. It's providing a context for that knowledge. And what you get when you join the military and the different places you travel and the different adventures you have and the hardships you go through is you start to develop a context or to get a context in which that knowledge makes sense when you get back to university. And that's what I found since I've returned.
Do you feel comfortable in both the military and intellectual worlds or a little out of place in each?
It took some adjustment at first, but I can say that it's fairly seamless now when you stop viewing them as separate parts and you start viewing them as something that's part of a greater whole.
John, four deployments in Afghanistan, 200 combat missions. Do I have those stats right?
More or less. Sometimes those days kind of blended together.
Does that put you in the top few percent of time on the front lines?
Well, the unit I was in took part in a task force. I was in 1st Ranger Battalion, and they're a special operations unit, and we went after a lot of the high-value targets in both Iraq and Afghanistan. So it was a interesting perspective there to be part of the task force that went after most of the people you heard about in the news. And it also lent for us to not have much rest while we were overseas.
I guess. How close did you ever get to Osama bin Laden?
Closer than most. I actually was part of a reconnaissance unit in which we spent a lot of time on the border doing a lot of research and reconnoitering all the routes into Pakistan where he would be. Unfortunately, it's a very, very thorny issue. There's a lot of logistical aspects of it, a lot of political implications for an action like that. And I don't see for us in the future doing a lot on that front.
When you say political ramifications, do you think you could have gotten them, but it was too politically difficult for some reason for the higher-ups?
I think that the chances of success for the mission to be successful is very low. Just the type of terrain that's out there, the type of infiltration methods, and also the number of Pakistani militia that's there on the border. It's very difficult to kind of have everything line up and to be able to execute a mission that would not be disastrous, just because, you know, the task force is a very limited number of people, and to go onto the border with, you know, four special operations helicopters, you know, in a very volatile region that has, you know, battalions of Pakistani militia that, you know, have questionable loyalty in an area which is completely supportive of that network and, you know those set of targets. It unfortunately will take a lot more political will. At the same time, you know, you have to kind of look at the benefits of that action. What do we benefit from? you know, that action at that time, because, I mean, as you can see in Afghanistan, a lot of the mission is centered on, you know, stabilizing the region, stabilizing the country, and stabilizing the border.
That's about as clear a description of that dilemma as I think our listeners have ever heard. Before we move on to your colleague, how did 200 combat missions affect your view of civilian life now that you're back?
Like Rory says, I think the transition has been seamless, and a lot of it has to do with the veterans that are around me. I participate in ROTC. I'm also an officer in our veterans group here, and having my peers around me here at the School of General Studies at Columbia is a very soothing thing. It keeps me kind of one foot into that culture. Now, school gets the best of us. You know, despite of our combat experiences overseas, at the same time, you know, we have to think about exams and studying and you know, the normal rigors of a student. Unfortunately, I couldn't join you in your studio because I have a class shortly after this, so I cannot miss those.
But. So fighting the Taliban is one thing. Fighting Comp Lit is a whole other, right?
Absolutely.
Daniel, you joined the Radio Reconnaissance Platoon. Now,
yes,
anything with radio in the name must be a good thing. What does that mean you did?
We provided signals intelligence support to different units in the military, both in the Marine Corps and in the Army. And we specifically supported reconnaissance units or Army Special Forces units. And my experience in Iraq was serving with those type of units. My experience was perhaps a little tamer than John's, simply because when I was there, it was shortly after the surge and the Anbar Awakening. So the area that I was in was quite calm, but the missions that we were designed to handle were similar to what John's talking about.
Now, Wheeling, West Virginia, to Anbar Province, to 116th Street in Manhattan,
yes,
is quite a cultural whiplash ride.
It is.
What have you learned through all this change? What have you learned about yourself through all this change?
I've learned a lot about myself. I've learned that no two places are the same. No two places require the same skill set. You need to sort of adapt and learn from your environment and as things are coming at you, and really just have an open mind about everything. I think that going to the Marine Corps from a small town in West Virginia was enough of a culture shock, and then coming to New York City has been, in many ways, an equal culture shock.
What's surprising to you about New York?
The cliched saying, I guess, is it's a wonderful place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there.
Because?
Well, I visited and I had a great time when I visited Columbia and when I visited the city, and I loved it. And then when I came to live here, I realized that it's quite difficult. I mean, there's a lot of it presents a lot of logistical problems just moving about the city and doing, you know, just errands. And then going to school is I think there's this perception in the military, when you're in the military, that civilian life is easy or that school is easy. And I've discovered that it's definitely not the case.
You want to be a comparative literature major, I gather. What's
yes.
a former fighter from West Virginia going to do with a degree like that?
Well, my standard refrain is that I've thought about going into journalism, teaching, or law. And literature has always been my passion. I had a couple of really great teachers in high school whom just really opened my mind to all kinds of great stuff.
Do you have some favorite authors?
I do. I really like Tom Wolfe, which is, you know, he's a big sort of New York staple. I like a lot of authors from the South, such as the name escapes me right now.
That's right, Faulkner.
Faulkner, yes. I'm thinking of a Catholic writer, and I can't. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name right now. But
Flannery O'Connor.
No, Walker Percy.
Oh,
I'm
Walker
sorry.
Percy.
Yes. Drew Blake there for a second.
The what was that? The book about something about film, right?
Moviegoer.
The Moviegoer,
yes.
Right. All right, we are talking to Iraq and Afghanistan veterans on this Veterans Day. John McClellan, Daniel Flatley, and Rory Minnis, who are all attending Columbia University. Now, I want to make sure to get in that you're all getting some funding from the new GI Bill and from some other things like the Green to Gold scholarships or Yellow Ribbon Program money. You want to talk about how you qualify and how other veterans listening might take advantage? Because there's money out there, Rory, that that some vets may not even know is available if they want to go to college.
Absolutely, Brian. I would actually defer this question to John because he's taking the point on a lot of these programs inside of our organization. But there's plenty of opportunities out there for the taking.
Okay, John, go ahead.
Well, the Yellow Ribbon Program is – okay, well, let's start off with the GI Bill. The GI Bill is for any veteran that served for 3 years after 9/11. There are different few caveats to that depending if you served less than that or if you served in reserve capacity. But for the most part, if a veteran has done 3 years – in the service, they're eligible for it. Now, that pays for any public school wherever you go in the United States. So any public school will be free, free of charge. In addition to that, VA paying for your full tuition, you get what's called basic allowance for housing. Now, that's a living stipend based upon your area. For New York, it's about $2,744 a month. In addition to that, you get a book stipend and also and it's really the book stipend. Now, as we know, Columbia is a lot more expensive than a lot of the CUNYs or the SUNYs.
Right. The GI Bill gives you up to the most expensive public university in a given state.
Yes.
Which I think in New York would be about $15,000, something like that, for a SUNY school.
It is a very substantial amount. So that is very good for what I'm coming to.
But that's about $15,000, and Columbia is about $50,000 a year for a full-time student, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And what they do now is called the Yellow Ribbon Program. Now, the Yellow Ribbon Program, the school has to opt in. It has to say, you know, we are going to participate. And what they'll do is the VA will split the cost 50-50 with the school. So for Columbia, the remaining amount of tuition is about $10,200. And so Columbia will do $5,100, and the VA will match it dollar for dollar. Most of us here are the School of General Studies, and it's about 150 veterans that they'll pay for at the full amount. So they've created, like, Columbia has been extremely supportive. A lot of schools have been extremely supportive, but, you know, in our case, Columbia has, by giving us the opportunity to come and giving a lot more veterans to come. So, you know, I'm going to make this pitch that, you know, there is free education out there, and most veterans should take advantage of it and then use it, you know, to give back to the public.
How do the students react to you at Columbia? Is it, do people look at you like you're from Mars because of your background, or is it pretty cool?
I think with Columbia and New York, there's a lot of graduate students. There's a lot of older people around, and there's a lot of diversity. So we are able to eke out a niche here. And most of the students, I would say every student, I've never had a bad experience here, has been supportive. They are very supportive of the experience. They listen. They would like to talk about what a bird's eye view, or actually the greater perspective that you may possess. I mean, everybody has political disagreements, but Columbia is an intellectual atmosphere where you can agree to disagree, and I've never had a argument that has gone out of hand. And I think, you know, Daniel and Rory can probably
agree. Daniel, you're finding the same thing?
Definitely. I think that it helps the students to see that we're formed by our military experience and not defined by it, that we can branch out, and that we're regular men and women who have hopes and dreams and things that we want to accomplish in our lives that are beyond the military, but we've also chosen to serve our country. And I think that having that, bringing that perspective to the classroom and doing it in sort of a quiet, sort of just having a presence and a bearing there, and not really forcing that perspective on anyone, just engaging in the intellectual dialogue is quite
good. And the school itself, Columbia, Rory, reaches out, you were saying, and puts veterans together through the School of General Services and does something to kind of integrate you back into college life in particular?
Well, the school that all three of us are part of, the School of General Studies, has been absolutely tremendous in letting veterans know that there are Ivy League education opportunities out there for them. I remember the first time I actually came here to try to find information about the School of General Studies, I looked at their publication, their actual magazine, the periodical they put out, and on the front cover there were three Marines in dress blues. And I said, all right, I'm in the right place. This is good to go. The Dean of Students, Peter Ahn, is absolutely fantastic and is absolutely all about veterans. They have actually put together trips where they go and recruit on military bases around the country, which is unheard of. You know, actually sending delegations to recruit for the School of General Studies from military bases, and I think that's tremendous.
I played the clip of General Shinseki before, and so much of the media focus today, really driven by him, is on homeless veterans and the prevalence of homelessness among veterans being more than twice as much as among the rest of the adult population. Is this something you guys have thought about? You're on, you know, such a different track, it seems, towards success going to Columbia. Rory, I'll stay with you for a minute. Why do you think veterans become homeless more than other people? Is it something about the experience of having been in?
Well, I think, in all honesty, Brian, that we'd be fooled to ignore that the stresses that are undertaken by our men and women in uniform during in combat environments are tremendous. And the potential to slide backwards into a potentially bad situation is there for any veteran returning. It depends on the support structures that are in place, the friends, the family that are around them. And that's what's tremendous also about the military veterans at Columbia University is because there's so many of us, we have each other, we have that common bond and experience, and allows us to depend on one another to keep our head above water.
Daniel, is this something you think about, what's needed?
It is, and I think that the Yellow Ribbon Program and the new GI Bill sort of helped to reincorporate veterans into American society at large. I think that, you know, over the years, there's sort of become this disconnect between the military and civilian society, and I think that it's good to sort of try to marry those two up again and kind of reincorporate everyone into, you know, what we are.
General Shinseki has set a zero homeless vets goal for 5 years. Think he can do it?
I think he can. I mean, it would be quite difficult, I'm sure, but I think we're moving in the right direction.
One more thorny issue before you both or you all go, John. What was your reaction to the Fort Hood shooting?
It was an absolute tragedy. I was a medic in the military, and I have done a lot of work in the soldier readiness processing center. A lot of the different places where I have been one of the people giving shots to, you know, soldiers deploying, and, you know, soldiers coming back. And so it does hit close to home that, you know, somebody that we trust so much, you know, an officer in the United States military, will commit such heinous crimes. I hope that, you know, the investigation goes far and deep, and that they find out what happened, and then that they institute new measures to make sure that we can recognize, you know, troubled individuals to make sure that this does not happen again.
Daniel, is it you who wants to go back as a judge advocate general? Or John, is that you?
That is me, sir.
Focusing, I read in your notes, on civil rights cases, among other things. Do you think there's a policy response that's needed to Fort Hood that's neither discriminatory nor politically correct, given the background of the alleged shooter? You get all the hard questions.
That's fine. That's why I chose to come on here. I don't think specifically with his background, like that we have to target that population. I think we just need to be more receptive and more open and approaching to the topic of diversity in the military. I mean, the military is an extremely diverse place. We have a lot of different people from many different socioeconomic backgrounds. One of my best friends in the military is a Muslim soldier. In my ROTC unit, we have Muslim soldiers, and they are some of the best soldiers I know. So it definitely wouldn't be something to single out an individual population. I think soldiers do have problems over here. You know, we are fighting a war that is very unpopular right now. Both of them are very unpopular. And so people are creating this conflict in their mind, this existential conflict about going overseas or coming back. It's a very significant and meaningful experience. I think that's a lot of the problems why we have a lot of homeless veterans here, because when you come back from overseas, I mean, I was fortunate enough to have, you know, a veterans group, a support structure, you know, the regimens of military life kind of in the city. I did feel myself slipping a couple times because it's such an important and meaningful experience that, you know, to come back and kind of, you know, just forget about it, you know, like it's ephemeral, like it's a dream. You know, some people can't handle that. And, I mean, I like to point out that the new GI Bill is the biggest step in that direction. Back in World War One, the remedy for soldiers slipping by was prohibition. World War Two, they decided that prohibition was not a good idea, that we need to take care of our soldiers, and then they passed the GI Bill. The GI Bill had, over time, was slipping because it wasn't covering the full cost of education, but now it is again. And so, you know, that's the one thing I want to impress on any veterans listening to this show, is that take advantage of the benefits here. This will get you through it.
A great message. John, given the difficulty that you were describing before of getting high-value targets in Afghanistan and Pakistan after going on 200 combat missions there, do you have an opinion about what the United States should do in Afghanistan as the president is trying to figure it out? Can we really do nation-building or succeed militarily where much meaner empires like the Soviets have failed, you know, all in the pursuit of preventing another 9/11?
I have thought about this question long and hard, and overseas and back here. And, I mean, admittedly, I should take a neutral stance, but I'm going to say that it is not good to increase troop levels.
Wow.
In Afghanistan, and it is not in our interest to be in that country. We have to recognize not only the capabilities, you know, of our military, which are great, and the amazing sacrifice of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. At the same time, we have to look at the limitations. We can't win the Afghan hearts and minds at the barrel of a gun. And unfortunately, where we once were part of the solution, I think now more and more increasingly we're becoming part of the problem.
I think Colombia is getting to you. No, I'm kidding. But that is quite a statement. Rory, Dan, do you want to go there at all before you go, one side or the other of that question? You don't have to.
I have to say that I haven't thought as long or hard about it as John has, so I'm going to say no comment on that.
Rory?
I'm going to have to agree that I don't think that I have the tools, the information in front of me to make an accurate call on that. I would say that that region, though, is particularly the Afghanistan-Pakistan region, is a region that is of considerable concern to us and something that we do need to keep our thoughts focused on, if not our troops.
John McClellan and Daniel – now I've misplaced your names. Daniel
– Flatley.
And Rory Minnis. All three Iraq or Afghanistan war veterans, now all three attending Columbia University. Thank you so much for spending part of your Veterans Day with us. Thank you again for your service.
Thank you, Brian.
And go Lions.
Thank you, Brian.
Jim, could I add one thing? Just, you know, to all the listeners, you know, just remember the veterans and that there are still two wars going on. Just very recently, this past month, I had three of my good friends get killed in southern Afghanistan. So I hope that kind of brings a context that support the troops and, you know, be responsible citizens.
Hear, hear. And we'll do more on Veterans Day later in the program, including playing more from President Obama's speech at Fort Hood yesterday, where he talked by name about some of the victims. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.